Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. Hi there. I'm so excited for you to hear this episode. It is the keynote from Sustainability Talks at Waste Expo, and it is none other than Bill Caesar from Generate Capital. And you may know Bill from his seasoned and storied career in the waste and recycling industry. And now he has moved over to Generate and has so much to share about organics and how sustainability is good for business and just the intersection of our industry and sustainability, where it stands and what the future looks like. It's a must listen, and I hope you get a lot out of it. I know we certainly did. Enjoy.
Just a little bit on my background for those of you who don't know me, and these lights are right in my eyes, so I can't see you very well, so I'm hoping you're listening. So I spent the last 6 years from 2014 to 2020 as a CEO of a company called WCA Waste, which was a traditional solid waste disposal collection and recycling business, headquartered in Houston, owned by private equity, sold to GFL Environmental in September of 2020. Before that, I ran the recycling business at Waste Management and was also responsible for the portfolio of investments that Waste had made in early stage technologies and services. And I've been at Generate Capital now for the last 15 months or so. So I came into the waste industry in 2010, having been a management consultant for about 13 years. And a good part of that time, I spent looking at biofuels and bio-based chemicals and the waste industry. So I've been around the space, one form or another of the sustainability space, for probably the last 15 or 16 years. I'm not going to claim that I have a unique perspective on the sustainability and business topic, but I think I at least have an informed perspective on that. And I want to share a few things with you today. And I'm guessing this is a pretty, an audience that is on team sustainability. So hopefully this is not going to be a hostile crowd when I go into some of those things. So to start with, I'm just going to give you a quick overview I want to talk about. So there are three things. One, I want to talk about all the tailwinds that are supporting the growth of sustainability-based businesses. There's a lot of positive things in the market right now. I told you I've been looking at this space for 16 years. I mean, when the same business models are bouncing around for 10 years, and some of them have been, in particular, some of the chemical recycling technologies, and have yet to really get off the ground, you got to wonder, well, what's different this time? There are some things different this time, and I want to highlight a few of those. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the wide variety of sustainable business models that are out there. There is a lot out there. I've probably, in the last year, I have seen, I'm going to guess, 50 or 60 different business plans from companies, some early stage, some not early stage, but there are a lot of people looking at a lot of different ways to do things with material that otherwise would have been called waste. And then I'm going to spend the last bit of time talking about the organic waste space, which is a place where I think there's a great deal of opportunity, where the tailwinds supporting organic waste are much stronger than they've ever been. But also highlight some of the challenges with managing organic waste, which is one of the reasons why I think it's one of the last places that you're starting to see a lot of focus on. So let's get started with the tailwinds. First, consumer preferences are pushing brand owners and manufacturers to be more sustainable. I was at a dinner two nights ago with one of the founders of a company called Loop Industries that does deep of PET. And I was remarking on my age relative to his. I'm 56, I think he was 27. And I said, I really don't do the social media thing. And he said, well, that is why the brand owners are changing their tune, because all the kids are on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook, and they're making noise, and the brand owners are hearing them. And that is part of the reason why you're seeing them react in the way that they are today, that they've never reacted in the past, which is fundamentally changing the way they think about this space and where they're willing to put their money. Next, share owners. They're driving sustainability and ESG thinking. Now, when I talk about share owners, I'm talking about the limited partners in private equity funds. I'm talking about the big institutional investors like BlackRock, who are leaning on the folks who are investing their money or who are managing their money in a way that they've never done before. I don't know if I have any of my Macquarie friends here. The Macquarie Infrastructure and Real Assets was the private equity firm that owned WCA Waste. And for five of the six years that I was running WCA, we didn't talk a whole lot about sustainability. And then all of a sudden, somebody got religion. And it was, hey, this has gotten important to our LPs. And if it's important to our LPs, it's important to us. And if it's important to us, it's important to you. And so you're really seeing that pressure come down in a way that, I don't think existed before more than a couple years ago. Regulators, depends on the state you're in. If you're in California, regulators are absolutely pushing a sustainability agenda. If you're in New York State, they're kind of pushing a sustainability agenda. If you're in New England, generally yes. If you're in the Southeast, not as much. But the fact is that there is a lot of support out there that's impacting different parts of the business and generally making things easier, although there's another challenge that I'll get to in a minute, but generally making things easier for sustainable businesses to get off the ground. Next are the investors. And by investors, I'm talking about the actual guys who run the private equity funds. I live in Houston. WCA was headquartered in Houston. I worked at Waste Management for a while in Houston. And Houston is chock full of folks who invest in the oil and gas sector. And until maybe 2019, even into 2020, that's what they did. And then all of a sudden, a lot of these PE firms that used to invest in various places along the value chain in oil and gas decided that they needed to be green, or at least as green as they could get. And now you're seeing, I won't mention the name of the firm, but I was at a lunch yesterday where a gentleman from one of these firms was speaking and he was introducing himself and the importance of climate change and sustainable business models and looking for ways to reduce and reuse waste that was core to their fund's strategy. And I just looked at the guy next to me and I didn't say anything, but the guy looked back at me and said, "You gotta be freaking kidding," all right? Because that's not where they were a couple years ago. And now all of a sudden it is who they are. And it's interesting to see that evolution. And the last one is C-suites. The people are actually running companies. I think a few years ago, when you looked at things that were quote unquote sustainable, in particular in the waste industry, you were doing them because you had to. It was a compliance matter. I think we've seen a real shift now where companies are starting to see the opportunities that sustainability brings. And it is not a compliance thing. It is a competitive advantage thing. It is a growth thing. That same lunch I was at yesterday, there were a couple guys who run waste businesses in California there. And they were both talking about the fact that as they added composting capacity and other waste diversion capacity as a result of SB 1383, they were able then to go back to the communities, the municipalities, the franchise owners that they work with and extend their contracts and increase the prices for the work that they're doing. And to them, it was like, hey, this sustainability thing's not so bad. Wow, I have no idea what that is. But I'll just keep going with my presentation. So there's been a big change, and these are, I think these are the core things behind that. So there's a few other things going on that are supporting it, a lot of environmental factors. But another one is there are a handful of technologies that are making things easier. Among those, artificial intelligence, blockchain, robotics, certain conversion technologies. One of the reasons why things like blockchain are important is because if you're going to get value from doing something sustainable, the folks on the other side want to be sure that what you're doing is what you said you were doing. They want traceability. They want to know that you're actually doing something to reduce carbon. You're not just saying that you're doing it. The next is the amount of money that is flowing into what I'll call sustainable investing. I found a fact that quoted that there were $51 billion invested in the sustainability sector in 2020. And in 2021, that number had more than doubled to $120 billion. There are parts of the environmental services sector today that there is more money chasing fewer projects that exist. And it's a little bit of an unusual circumstance. I'm not going to say that's across the board, but there are certain sectors, for example, dairy waste digesters. There's more money there than there are opportunities there. And that creates its own dynamic as things get bid down. Tracking and auditing processes, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, these are key. Your ability to measure your carbon intensity score on whatever you're doing is critical. The fact that there are still in process but generally agreed ways to do that everyone accepts are important for all this to take off. And then finally, there are people who are actually making money doing this. And that is perhaps the most important of all these points. It's nice for there to be a great environment. It's nice for there to be support. But is anybody actually making money? And I think the answer to that, which I can speak to directly, because at Generate Capital, we are indeed making money in this space. It can be done. And I'm sure there will be others who are going to follow in our footsteps and who are beside us right now as we do that. So let's take a little bit of step back. That's all the environmental stuff, all the background stuff. There's lots of ways to build sustainable businesses. You can build or operate renewable energy resources. You can deploy or design energy efficiency devices. You can use efficient materials. You can electrify to displace high carbon emitters. Or you can engage in circular activities. I'm mostly going to focus on the last one here, because that's the bit that touches the waste industry the most. Because managing waste is a prominent feature, in particular, of that last one, on that circular activity. This next slide, I don't expect you all to be able to read this. I do expect some of you to be familiar with it. This is what is known as the circular economy butterfly chart. It first appeared in a book called Cradle to Cradle, which was written by Bill McDonough and Michael Brongart, probably back in 2012, 2013 maybe. The point of this chart was to say that regardless of the nature of the material that you're working with, whether it is a renewable material or whether it at its heart is a finite, inert material, there are different ways to manage them in a circular environment. If you go down the green side, which is the renewable part, you want to try and extract as much value from that material as you convert it into some form of energy or some other form of material before you bring it back and start that process all over again. On the finite material side, it's all about finding ways to design whatever your device is to minimize waste, and then to find ways to reuse or repurpose the materials once you've put them in. So this is sort of the big world of what can you do in the circular economy space, in the sustainability space. Now I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this page because I want to sort of give you a tour de force of what sorts of things people are trying to build businesses based on. And I'll walk through these and give you a few examples. I'll start with the easiest one, which is at the top of my pile of trash here, which is the MSW to energy. This has been around for a while. This was the original Covanta wheel abrader model of I'm going to convert waste to electricity. There are people who are trying to do this in more sophisticated ways. There are people who are trying to do this in a way that allows them to extract fiber and put that back into recycled paperboard. There are some neat things happening there on a, I'll call it a theme that's been around for a very long time. Textile recycling. Interesting one, hard one. If there's anyone here from the Closed Loop Fund, they've invested in a couple businesses that are trying to find ways to repurpose typically your polyesters or your nylon fibers. Sometimes they're doing cotton. But interesting business models here. Again, I'll mention the Loop Industries guys. One of the things that they're trying to do is upcycle PET. When most of us think of PET, we think of water bottles. And as the Loop Industries guys told me, actually, you know, 75% of the PET produced in the world today goes into textiles. And what we want to do is we want to take that textile material, we're going to depolymerize it, repolymerize it, and turn it into a food-grade PET, which is a very different model than typically we see in sustainability, which is I'm taking something of a higher value and I put it through whatever my process is and it comes out as a lower value item. Here they're taking a lower value item and upcycling it. Next, auto shredder residue. With anybody who's been in the waste industry knows is kind of a product we don't like to deal with. It has properties that can sometimes cause fires. It can be nasty to handle. But there were a couple of guys out there that have figured out a way to strip the metal component of ASR out of all the other plastic and metals and have got, I think in the next year or two, we're going to see that ASR has become one of those little piles of money out there that nobody knew because nobody knew how to extract the value from it. MSW to building products. Waste Management just invested a boatload of money with a private equity firm to take MSW to produce a material used in roofing materials. We're probably gonna see some other variations on that theme too. C&D waste energy, this one's fairly simple. Shred C&D, take it to a cement kiln, use it to fire your cement kiln. That one's been around a little while. Not really taken off in the United States. It's much more of a European thing. It's legitimate use of that material. Scrap metal sorting. This is gonna be interesting, especially with the values of metals today. When we talk about headwinds, I didn't even get into the whole global commodity run-up as a tailwind, but that is absolutely going to be behind some of these things. This company in particular that I've done some work with has figured out a way to sort the different grades of aluminum, not just the alloys, but also the cast from the wrought. And when you're able, as anybody who's done anything in recycling, when you're able to keep like with like, the value of those things is much greater than when you have a whole bunch of different things, even if they're in the same family, because they all go to the least common denominator. But when you're able to keep the wrought with the wrought and the rolled with the rolled and alloy 5 with alloy 6, they're actually worth a lot more. Electronics recycling's been around for a long time. I don't want to go into that too much. EV battery recycling. This is an interesting one because I did look at this space fairly closely, and there are at least four or five different companies out there that have raised a lot of money on EV battery recycling. I'm not sure exactly how this one is gonna play out. I learned something when I was looking at this space, which is that EV batteries, when they're in the car, car is a very challenging environment for a battery. Starts and stops, pulls on power, and so it can degrade over time. But that battery actually has a whole second life as a battery storage device, electrical storage device. And so when I look at this space, I'm like, there's absolutely going to be EV battery recycling, but it may not be for 20 years until it peaks out. Now, I'm not an expert on this one, but I do know that my Tesla, which I've had since 2014, has not degraded at all, and I'm 8 years in. So let's say I go another 2, 3, 4 years, and then my battery in my car turns into a battery storage device at some industrial plant, it's gonna be maybe 20 years before you have large scale need for recycling of EV batteries. That's my guess. I'm sure there are guys who are much closer to it, but it's one of the things that we looked at. Chemical recycling, there are at least 30 or 40 companies in the world today that are trying to figure out how to do chemical recycling. I think it will eventually work. I think having $100 crude oil prices and $8 natural gas prices will help them work. Because in my mind, the technology has never really been the challenge there. The challenge has been to do it efficiently and to make a product that has high demand. And in this particular case, not only do you have those high commodity prices, which you're comparing your product to, but you have extraordinary demand from brand owners who want to have recycled content in their packaging. In Europe, it's a regulatory requirement. In the US, it's voluntary, but it's very real. And if you can use your chemical recycling process to create a product that can go into a refinery and go into a polyethylene or a polypropylene and come out, and you can call your bottle that you made from that resin 30% recycled content, there's a lot of demand for that. And then last one, tires to polymers and carbon black. Tires are actually a big problem. And I would love for somebody to figure out how to make this one work. I haven't seen it yet. I've seen several people trying to do it. There have been a few plants built. But this one is one I think in the same category of ASR, there's going to be somebody who figures it out before too long. So a lot of waste-related sustainable business models out there. What I want to do now is talk about organic waste, because organic waste is one of those things that I have not seen a bunch of business models on. There are a few technologies out there, tried and true, that have been out there. But I think there are conditions today that make it a little more attractive. It's still hard. Part of the reasons why organics are important, anybody who has looked at someone who, state or municipality that has said that we want to go to 75% diversion. I think Florida had that 10 years ago. They're going to go to 75% diversion from landfills. And everybody said, okay, well, we can get to 40% with traditional recycling. And then we're going to have to figure out how to go after some of the stuff that we don't know how to recycle yet. And the next thing that was on the table, the next biggest part, was the organic fraction of MSW. And everybody looked at each other and said, that's going to be hard, because that might require some changes in the way consumers behave. And when we try to change the way consumers behave, it can get real hard. But so let's talk about why it's important. 40% by weight of landfill tons are organic matter. A little over 20% of that is food waste, 12% is yard waste, 6% is wood. That's from the 2019 EPA statistics. That's a lot of material that there's a potential to do something useful with. 65 million tons of food waste are created in the US. 52.4 million tons of that are sent to landfills. If I remember the last time I saw the EPA numbers, 280 million tons of waste went into landfills. So there's some discrepancy between the 40% and the 52 million and the 300, but I think we can easily say it's a lot. There are clear environmental consequences to food waste in landfills that are not good. The GHG emissions of the food waste in the US are estimated to represent the amount of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere from 37 million cars. I checked to see how many cars were actually on the road in the US, and that number was a little over 100 million. So basically, if you could handle food waste in a way that reduced the emissions, you could do the equivalent of taking a third of the cars off the road. It's a big deal. And then finally, there's some research on how much money was gonna be spent on food waste management over the next few years. I don't know if I trust this number, $43 billion in the next couple of years. That seems like a lot. I'm not sure exactly what they were measuring. This is one of those reports that cost $7,000. I read the abstract, I did not buy the report. You guys all know the ones I'm talking about. But it's still a very big number. So I look at the space and I go, managing organic waste is a focus area for waste generators, whether they like it or not. Waste haulers, regulators, brand owners, and consumers, but it's a hard one, right? It's a hard thing to deal with. It requires changes in the way the normal process of collecting and disposing of waste works. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that this isn't the first time we've tried to handle organic waste. And I'm going to get to the right side of this page in a second. But I want to talk a little bit in the abstract on the left side. So there's lots of ways that businesses can fail. You can have a great idea and have really bad execution. Doesn't mean that somebody shouldn't try again. You can have a bad idea, and it doesn't really matter if the execution matters. It doesn't really matter how well you execute it. It's not going to work. But you can also have great ideas, but something critical was missing. The timing, you didn't have the funding, the technology wasn't quite there, the customer demand wasn't there. And I think that was a little bit where we were with organics a decade ago. Now I'm going to talk about the picture on the right side. In 2014, a company called Harvest Power built an anaerobic digester in Orlando specifically for Disney World to use. They were going to bring their organic material from the park. It was going to be digested. They're going to make biogas. They're going to create electricity. Sound like a great idea. I don't know exactly what went wrong. This was 2014. It was touted as the next great thing. And in 2021, this facility here, which should have had a life of 20 years, was dismantled and sold for scrap. I don't know the details. I own anaerobic digesters. It didn't have to go that way, but something went wrong, and I'm not sure exactly what it was. And maybe my guys behind me will figure out how to get my slides back up, but in the meantime, I'm going to continue to talk, even if you can't see this picture. There it is, super. All right, so this is not I don't believe this to be a technology issue. I don't believe this to be a feedstock issue. I don't believe this to be a customer issue. I don't know why it failed. All I know is it did. Something didn't work right. There are a lot of other challenges around managing organic waste. It is more costly than the alternative, which is just to pick up everything in the same bin, to collect it and process it. Right? Somebody has to be interested enough to spend a little more money on it. If you're a hauler, that's another pass of a truck. Maybe it's a different type of truck. Maybe it's a different type of bin that you have to invest in order to manage that. It requires additional resources for the generators of waste. They have to separate their food waste from whatever other waste they're generating. And then someone has to be willing to spend the money on whatever processing equipment you're going to use. So if the alternative is to pick everything up in a truck, take it to the landfill, we're asking you to do something different. It causes behavior change, causes investment requirements in order to make it work. The collection companies that don't have their own organics processing are obviously disincentivized by being asked to do this. They're going to lose money. It's going to cost them something to do this. They may invest in those assets, those processing assets, and they may get a return on that. But until they do that part, they're likely going to see this as something that works against them. So that makes it all hard. So what's changed? A handful of things I think are pretty important, some of which come back to those tailwinds that I talked about. Communities and waste generators, the demand for organics processing, for landfill diversion, and their willingness to pay for it has absolutely changed. I take materials in at one of our anaerobic digesters in New York State, where the alternative is to go to a landfill, and I have a double handful of customers there who pay me more to get into my AD than they would if they took it to the landfill down the road. That was not something that existed 5 years ago. This is new. People are willing to pay more. Why are they willing to pay more? Because corporate set some sustainability goals. And whether or not they bleed green or they're doing it because somebody's shareholders pushing them to do it, whatever the reason is, that message has worked its way down to the procurement person who has been given the marching orders, find non-landfill alternatives for the waste we're generating because I got to fill out a report and I'd really like to see those numbers go in the right way. And it's happening. And it's happening in a way that I would not have expected a couple years ago. The commodity markets and the regulatory supports for some of the materials that come out of organics waste processing. And I'll talk here specifically about renewable natural gas. In the hierarchy of natural gases, fossil-based natural gas today, I think, is around $8 an MMBTU. It was below $4 for a long time, but it's around $8 because of the war in Ukraine. At the super high end is renewable natural gas produced on dairy farms that have very low carbon intensity scores, which are sold into the LCFS market, go into transportation, they receive a RIN, and the revenue that you can generate from an MMBTU of dairy-based renewable natural gas is somewhere in the order of $70 to $80. That's a specialized group. Plain old food waste-based biogas produced at an anaerobic digester today, I can sell and contract for long-term somewhere between $24 and $28 an MMBTU. That's a lot different than what my friends at Harvest Power were trying to do 8 years ago. They were dealing with a no incremental value for their biogas. I'm getting somewhere on the order of 3 to 4 times what the fossil-based gas is worth. That's a big deal. Technology and process improvements. There's all the little things that come up. I don't think there's been any extraordinary move, but we're better at it today. We understand the value of different forms of food waste. I'm a guy who likes to do analysis, and I had my guys show me a chart of all of our different customers by the SKU of the material that they bring us, because a lot of this is packaged material that we depackage. And they knew the energy content of every type of material that that was being tipped on our floor, which is huge, because then I can go and say to the guy who's got low energy product, you know what, if you want space in my digester, it's going to cost you more because your stuff's not worth that much. And I can also go to the waste generator who's got primo grade stuff, super high energy, the bugs love it. And I can say, I will cut you a deal, friend, because I can make a lot of money off the waste that you're providing me. And that sort of insight helps you make better decisions about what you're doing. Because not all food waste is created equal. Management and operational knowledge, I'll call this normal stuff. We've gotten much smarter about how to pre-process material. In Canada, where you actually have a source-separated organics program, we have the ability to take nasty, post-consumer, curb-collected waste and turn it into something that we can put in the AD and crank out RNG on. And then finally, access to capital. Not just generate capital, but other players in the industry. There is money flowing into this space in a way that there wasn't before. And that means that you can upgrade your facilities, you can build facilities to the right scale, with the right types of equipment in there. One of the biggest changes, I think, in the AD space is that if you go back 10 years, everybody was trying to make electricity out of the biogas that you produced. Today, everybody wants to make RNG because it's worth a lot more. You have to pay a lot more, right? You have to get a biogas upgrade system. You have to find an interconnect. You may have to pipe your gas a short distance, a long distance. You're probably not going to be able to make it work. But if you can do those things, you can generate a lot more value. You just need the capital in order to invest in those things. And now, with the higher prices of RNG, you can justify that capital. This project that you see on the right-hand side of this page, built by the same guys that built the plant in Orlando, built outside of Toronto. I own this plant now. I don't know what is fundamentally different between this plant and the one in Orlando, except this one works, and works really well. This is an anaerobic digestion facility. I'll point out a couple things on here. In the back, in the middle, see those two big green containers, those two big green tanks. That's where the digestion actually occurs. When this picture was taken, there were two of them. There are now three of them, because we added 50% additional capacity late last year. If I show you a picture from a year from now, there'll be four of them, because I'm adding another one. In the bottom right, you can't really see it too well, is where the biogas upgrade system is. Right now, I can do 1,200 gigajoules, is I think the right term. By the end of this year, maybe into next year, I'll be doing 3,600. I'm going to triple my capacity to produce biogas. This is making money, or I wouldn't be reinvesting in it. There's a way to do it differently today. It's a function of the environment. It's a function of what consumers and what waste generators want. It's a function of what the market wants. There is a way to make this work. So there's lots of ways to capture value from organic matter. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on these, but look, you start with, worst case, you capture landfill gas. It's not elegant, it's not pretty, but it's valuable. You're not going to sell it for $24 an MMBTU because the CI score is not nearly as good as food waste and not anywhere near what dairy waste is. But there's value to doing that, and we should do it. Republic Services just announced a big deal to partner with somebody to get much better at collecting this gas. A lot of the gas that they're going to be processing as a result of this relationship, they had been flaring. There's a lot of gas that gets flared. We collect it. We're required to collect landfill gas as a regulatory requirement. We are not required to do anything with it. We just have to collect it. And in most cases, unless you have the right conditions and the right amount of capital, you're just flaring it. And now we figured out there's actually a lot of value in that material. Next, all right, if I'm better than taking it to the landfill, how about I just find a way to divert it? And there have been a lot of folks that have spent a lot of time, effort, and money to change the size of packaging, to change the size of portions, to change the way the food generating part of the business system handles food. And they've had some success. I don't know if you've noticed it, there's an organization called ReFed, which has a lot of brand owners in it. And when we had our first conversations back in 2016, everybody was like, okay, once the food goes into the waste bin, how do we make sure that we get some value out of that? And I remember very plainly saying, how about we keep it from getting into the waste bin in the first place? Because once, by the time it gets to me, there's not a whole lot I can do about it. But they went through and they said, hey, you know what? That expiry date on food, little secret, a lot of that was arbitrary. And they realized that, you know what, maybe if we're not so tight on those expiry dates, then we won't have as much food waste. And a lot of things changed on that side, and we're seeing the impact of that. So that's one way. Next, we make compost. I bought a composting business at the end of December this year. It is not the highest value generator of organic waste, but it's absolutely solid, and we're making money making compost. Not 80s don't work in every geography, not because of the climate, but because of the business environment, if I will. You need to have certain conditions for it to work, but composting is a perfectly acceptable solution. You can use food waste in there. It's a combination of green waste and yard waste. You can put the same food waste in. The same generators, the same brand owners that I'm working with in New York State and Michigan, I'm working with in South Carolina and Florida, because they also produce food in those areas, and I can put that material into my compost. Next, we talked about, I take that food waste, I convert it to electricity or to RNG. I can make bio-based chemicals. I don't know anybody that's doing it at scale quite yet, but there are people talking about doing. PLA is out there, polylactic acid. I don't know if I would say it's gotten a great deal of traction. It is functioning. That is typically going to be a food-based plastic, not necessarily a food waste-based plastic, but there are ways to do that too. And then finally, sort of at the highest level of the food waste value chain, is there are certain types of food waste that have a great deal of value as animal feed. And I'm talking about, in particular here, expired milk. Expired milk can go into feed for cattle, for pigs, and the growers, the breeders are they want that material because it's high in calorie. It helps them with what they're trying to do with their animals, and they're willing to pay a lot for that material. So lots of different ways to capture value. I'm going to talk a little bit about a real-world example. I talked to you about my site in London. This is my site in Fremont, Michigan, one of the largest anaerobic digesters in North America, 165,000 tons per year of food waste. For any of you guys who are sort of landfill guys, this is the equivalent of about a 500-ton-a-day landfill. Not gigantic, but it'll get your attention if 500 tons a day goes away. This is a material site. We acquired it in 2017. It had been idled. The guys who built it maybe 5 or 6 years earlier, not unlike the Disney project, it didn't work. They couldn't figure out how to make it work. I don't know what the cause was. I don't know if it was a customer thing. They were selling electricity. They might not have had a particularly good power purchase agreement. I don't know what it was. Today, I'm making money in Fremont, Michigan. Things have changed. Tip fees are higher. I know more about the food that I'm putting into my digester than I would have known 5 years ago, because I know what the energy content is, and I want more of that and less of that. And I'm able to manage this thing pretty effectively. We are producing power here today, just under 3 megawatts. My plan is to turn this into an RNG plant, because I've got enough gas that I can put in a biogas upgrade system. I'm not that far away from a natural gas pipeline, and I'm going to change the dynamics even more by doing that. So what can I do to enhance the value in Fremont? There's a handful of things. I have a depackaging facility there now where I get expired or mislabeled or otherwise off-spec food waste that has already been packaged. We break down those packages, we squeeze out the material that we want, and we do that in, a fairly rudimentary way right now. We're gonna upgrade this so that we can handle a lot more volume and a lot more different types of material. I just mentioned we're gonna put a biogas upgrade system in there. I'm going to add, with a partner, a process on the front end of my digester to pull out lactic acid. Not so that somebody can produce PLA, but lactic acid in and of itself is used in solvents and cleaners. It has value. About 12% of what I put in, of the food waste that I am collecting will go through this process and come out as lactic acid, and then I can digest the rest. So I'm gonna have an off-ramp for a high-value product before I put it in to make biogas. That will probably be something that is built in the next year. There is a customer who generates material that is high in lactic acid that is chomping at the bit for us to do this, because this will be a great thing for them, because they're gonna be able to divert a lot more material from landfill than they can today. And then finally, one of the biggest challenges with an AD is managing the effluent. The post, the material after it's been through the digester, you're typically land applying this material. That is one of the biggest challenges that we have. You have to truck it. Everybody knows what's happened with diesel prices. It's hard to find people who are willing to take this nutrient material, because essentially it is a fertilizer. And in the today environment, where natural gas-based fertilizers have gotten more expensive, I'm actually seeing more interest from farmers from my effluent. So there's another tailwind that sort of came out of nowhere that's going to help the economics of this. So my Fremont facility last week was nominated to be one of the finalists in the Biogas America's Best in the Business. In 2 weeks, in this very town, Biogas Americas is having their conference, and I hope to be able to tell everybody that we won that award. This was a facility that we basically bought idled in 2017. It was the next step, if we hadn't bought it, would have been selling it for scrap. A lot changes in 5 years. A lot changes in 5 years, and in the organic waste space, the ability to generate value from these assets that even just a few years ago were idle or not functioning, it's the game has fundamentally changed. So just a few sort of summary points here. One, a lot of tailwinds for sustainable business models today. Two, there's lots of different ways to build sustainable businesses. And there's lots of different waste products that can be repurposed in one form or another. Organic waste, in particular, has a lot of support behind it. Managing it is hard, and the incentives always aren't aligned, but it's a good business. And I strongly recommend anybody who has access to food waste or is thinking about food waste to look at it now in a different way than maybe you looked at it just a couple years ago. So I'm gonna stop there and ask, is there any questions? Like I said before, I can't see at all. So if you have a question, Liz, are you out there? Liz, can you help me identify questions?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm happy to take any question on any and all topics.
What do you see as the biggest challenges? Let's look at the waste industry specifically, the biggest challenges in reaching that sustainability, making advances in the area in the next few years?
The biggest challenges with the existing waste haulers?
Yeah, haulers and managers, yeah.
Okay. I think the biggest challenge today is that inertia is real, and that we're going to be asking people to do things differently. I think companies are more willing to do things differently than maybe they had been, either because of their own realization of the opportunity or because the folks who are funding them want them to do something different. But I think at the end of the day, the biggest challenge is that consumers, whether that be a community or a municipality, you're going to ask them to do something different, right? In Toronto today, and in most of Canada, they made a decision several years ago to collect organic waste on the curb. And they're willing to pay quite a bit for haulers to pick that up and for me to process that in Toronto. I have not seen that same willingness outside of maybe a handful of cities in the US. And I think that will be the challenge, is if we want to get, there's a little bit of an agency issue, right? So if I as a processor have the potential to make a decent amount of money with the material that I'm collecting from you and you're paying me for, you are benefiting as a individual person, because the climate is going to not change as quickly as it otherwise might have. But you don't have a tangible, in fact, you're probably going to pay more for the privilege of doing that. And so I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges, is getting people to change behavior. Companies are willing to do it. Individual residential customers, I think, are going to be hard. But it all depends on where you are, and different parts of the country have seen more or less success in changing things. I mean, there's still places in the U.S. that don't collect curbside recycling, right? And we're going to ask them to do something different with organics is going to be a little bit of a stretch. But other places are more willing to do those sorts of things.
Great talk. My name is Mikey. Nice to meet you. I'm still pretty new to the industry, but I just have a question about source separation. So you spoke about how you were able to articulate which food waste and which organic waste you wanted. Yep. Did you feel that was incredibly integral to your success? And then kind of a follow-up, do you feel that's what's holding back chemical recycling, where we're in this single stream system where we can't quite get that resolution of, I want this type, not this type, so on and so forth?
Yeah. Two very different parts of the waste stream, but I think I might be able to address them both. On the organic side, the insight into knowing what the energy content and the processability of different types of food waste is huge, because it helps you direct your sales force to go out and get certain types of material. It helps you price material properly. Within Generate, there's a little bit of a famous case. In 2021, late March, we got a load of Shamrock Shake from McDonald's. And I'm thinking, Shamrock Shake, that's got to be loaded with sugar. That was probably a good thing. Turns out it wasn't. Our bugs got sick, and it was a problem. Those are the hard lessons that you learn, because when bugs get sick in an AD, it's not good. Not good. And then I was having a conversation with our head of ops last week, and I said, are there other things that we need to be worried about? And he said, you know, the Shamrock Shake thing was real. We really had a problem. But we're better now. We could handle that in a way that we couldn't before, because we had a mechanical issue where what was happening is the super sugar stuff was staying in one place, and now we disperse it better and we manage it. But I think the short answer is, knowing what you've got and whether it's good for you or bad for you, or how good it is for you and how you price that, is critical to being successful. On the chemical recycling side, there are two very different tacks being taken today by different players in the industry. There are the guys who want one substrate. I want polypropylene, and I'll only polypropylene. I only want PET. And then there are the guys that are, give me, you're tired, you're hungry, you're poor, I'll take anything as long as it's plastic, and I will make something useful out of this. And there are two different paths. I tend to think that the guys who are going to go after the quote unquote mixed waste plastic are gonna be more successful than the guys who only want one substrate. And the reason that I feel that way is that it's hard to get a lot of only one thing. And if you build your plant too big, you're going to have a very big catchment area to go after that material. And even if you're getting post-industrial, not post-consumer plastics as your feedstock, I think it's going to be harder to do that. And you have to have a system that is robust enough to deal with the inevitable levels of contamination, right? So I tend to think that it's okay that we're not sorting plastic. I think there are ways for us to make mixes of different plastics that will then go into these processes that will optimize whatever their pyrolysis is or their gasification is, and they'll be able to make their naphtha or their synthetic crude, and it'll work. I think that's how it's going to work. I worry about the guys that are single substrate just because I think it's harder.
Good morning, Bill. It's Leon Young. Thanks for the presentation. I don't know if this is too broad-based or actually too in the weeds, but as the focus on PFAS increases, how does that factor? I was thinking in terms of the effluent that you land, and in compost, it's a growing problem. And I'm just kind of curious of your thoughts of how PFAS plays into this.
There are two headwinds in all this that I know of or that I can think of today. The first headwind is, this is great, everybody wants us to do this, but I really don't want you to do anything anywhere near me. The NIMBY crowd, or what I like to refer to as the banana crowd. The build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything crowd is still very much in force. No matter how green they are, they don't want anything that has anything to do with waste processing anywhere near them. Makes it hard to get stuff done. That's one headwind. Those guys are real. They make it hard. The other thing is this PFAS issue, which is not fully understood yet, is still in various stages of assessment, and different regulators are looking at it in different ways. I think the state of Maine made a decision about handling certain types of materials in the last few weeks that is related to trying to minimize PFAS in the environment. It is an issue. I guess right now there are a couple ways that we could deal with it if we feel like we have to deal with it. And I am not qualified to say whether or not we have to deal with it, because the fact of the matter is that it's everywhere, whether we like it or not. And I don't know that putting anaerobic digester effluent on a farmer's field is going to change the dynamic. And I'm not saying that because I think it doesn't. I'm saying that because I have no idea whether or not it does. There are technologies out there that allow you to sequester PFAS, especially in a aqueous solution. And then you decide, well, now that I've sequestered it into a dry material, what do I do with that? Can I put that into an incinerator? Can I put that into a lined landfill, knowing that it's going to stay there and that the leachate's going to be managed properly? Those are questions that I unfortunately think I will be dealing with over the course of the next 5 years, because I don't know. But it is absolutely a risk to doing anything with organic matter, whether it be biosolids or food waste or any other form of organic waste. That's a good question, Leon.
Thanks, Leon and Bill. We have one last question.
So Bill, you highlighted consumer behavior and those impacts on what we're talking about today. And I think to recycling and the efforts we've done over the years for educating consumers, do you see any potential lessons learned on what worked and what didn't work that could help drive the conversation?
That's a good question. I wish I had at my fingertips a list of places where I think it has worked. And I'm not saying that because I don't think that it has, but I'm saying that because I think that the number of places where education has had a fundamental difference in how residential waste generators treat recycling, I think it's limited, and it's limited to those places where a lot of effort was put into doing something. I have not seen anything broad-based. There's certainly nothing coming at the federal or, I would argue, meaningfully at the state level that is trying to educate consumers to do things differently. I mean, back in 2012, a decade ago, when the first challenge came from the Chinese with the green fence, the recycling industry had a handful of levers they tried to pull in order to manage through that situation. One of them was, part of our problem is that we have way too much contamination in our material, which was the excuse that the Chinese were using for not accepting material. There were lots of other things going on, but they weren't wrong on that. There was too much contamination in the material that we were producing, whether it be fiber or plastic or metals. But for 10 years, people have been trying, I think, more on the margins than super actively to change consumer behavior. I think there has been some impact. I would argue measurable, but not considerable. And I think if we're having trouble with getting people to put newspapers and Amazon boxes and aluminum cans and PET bottles and HDPE containers into their recycling bin without putting a lot of other crud in there, and we've only had marginal success, I can tell you what happens in Canada when they ask them to do the same thing with their organic waste that they generate at home. There's a lot of crud in there too, and it's not the crud that's supposed to be in there, and we have to sort it out. So I'm a little doubtful about how successful we've been and how successful we can be. I think it is really going to be a community by community thing, and it's going to be tough. You have to have a system that's robust enough to deal with contamination, and that's essentially what we've done. It's what the AD world has done. It is what the recycling world has done. We've gotten better at sorting. So I don't think the contamination rates at the MRFs have gone down considerably. Some cities, some localities absolutely have. But in general, it probably hasn't come down too much. But what has gotten better is our ability to sort that material. We are much, much better as a recycling industry than we were 10 years ago. And we realize that there is value in being much, much better because we get paid more for that material. And I think it's the economic incentives that are more likely gonna allow us to drive some of those changes than the incentives to sort of do the right thing. I think do the right thing gets you part of the way there, but in my own worldview, that something is only sustainable, truly sustainable, if it's economically sustainable. If something requires a subsidy, if something requires you to spend money to do something, it may not last too long. But if there's a virtual cycle there where whatever it is that you're doing is generating value for you or your community, then I think that those sorts of things have a chance to be successful. Okay.
Bill.
Thank you.